This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is going to be deep vein thrombosis or blood clots, and I'll introduce my guest, Dr. Michael Jaff, shortly. Before I do, I thought I would let you know that I've been listening to a series of podcasts produced by NPR. I think they're very interesting and very informative, and they relate to the U.S. healthcare system and how it compares with healthcare systems in the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Switzerland. Why this might be important is also, I think, worth sharing. You may not be aware, we have 47 million uninsured people in this country, another large group that is underinsured. We spend more money by far than any other country in the United, in the world, and despite this, we're sinking lower and lower in the common measures of health. These countries in Europe have virtually no uninsured, and the United Kingdom, for example, spends about half as much as we do. It's worth all of us becoming a little bit more educated about our healthcare system and some options around the world. If you're interested in hearing more about this and also looking at a comparison chart, go to npr.org/health. My guest today is Michael Jaff. Dr. Jaff is the medical director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Vascular Center. He is also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and a recognized authority on vascular disease and non-invasive assessment of these problems. Dr. Jaff, it's just a real pleasure to have you join us today.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Woodard. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with the obvious question. Why should we be discussing deep vein thromboses?
Well, I think there are a whole host of reasons, but probably the most important one is that this is likely the most common cause of death in hospitalized patients around the United States today. Now, that statistic in and of itself is worth taking pause. I think when most people think about going to the hospital, what might kill them, most think that it's infection or a mistake. But in fact, it really most likely is a blood clot. And the risk factors associated with these blood clots are seen commonly in hospitalized patients. So we're talking about, 2 million Americans a year get a blood clot in the leg. 600,000 who are hospitalized get a blood clot that ultimately goes to their lungs. And the really sobering statistic is that if you get a blood clot to your lung and you're at home, 10% of those people won't make it to a hospital.
So it's not necessarily, I mean, things that happen in a hospital might increase the risk, but just being in the hospital and having other factors is real. It's the combination that gets people into trouble, I'm guessing here.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So if you take probably the number one risk factor for cardiovascular disease in Americans today, that's obesity. Obesity in and of itself is a very strong predictor of future deep vein thrombosis. So there you go. You take somebody who's over age 40, that's a risk factor. Who's obese, there's a risk factor. Who's going for surgery, that will keep them at bed rest for a day or two, that's a risk factor. And you've got a triple whammy before you even do anything.
Mm-hmm. Let's back off 1 second, and it just dawns on me, perhaps we need to describe or paint a picture of what we mean by deep veins as opposed to perhaps superficial and even maybe arterial. What's the difference here in what kinds of vessels are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great point. So in general, we have two channels of blood that keep us all healthy, leading from the heart to the farthest regions of the body, fingertips, toes, nose, earlobes, you name it. Our arteries, these are strong muscular tubes, and they can accept the blood that's propelled from the heart out to these far distant reaches of our body. They carry healthy, oxygen-rich blood, deliver it to where the body needs it, all the way out as far as it needs to go. So those are arteries, strong muscular tubes. Then there are tubes that carry blood from the farthest regions of the body back to the heart, and those are called veins. Now, contrary to arteries, these are thin-walled. In fact, if you held a vein outside the body up to a light, you could literally see through it. And veins have these little valves inside them, clever little things that are one-way valves that help propel blood from the feet back to the heart, from the fingertips back to the heart, and not go the wrong direction. So with muscle in the arms and legs, it pumps the blood through these valves up the veins, back to the lungs where it collects oxygen, goes back to the heart, and then starts the whole cycle over again. So those are the differences between arteries and veins. What we're talking about today is deep vein thrombosis, so these thin-walled, valve-filled tubes that carry blood from the farthest regions back to the heart. Now, we talk about deep and superficial vein thrombosis, a very important point. I bet you everybody who's listening to you now has walked through it down a street on a summer day in a shopping mall and seen people with those large, ugly, purple, clustery-like varicose veins.
Mm-hmm.
Those are superficial veins. Those veins run just underneath the skin. And frankly, for most of the time, those veins are not the type that can cause blood clots to the lungs. There are exceptions to that, but for the most part, they cannot. It's the deep veins that you can't see, these large tubes that run deep inside the muscle along the main bones of the legs. Those are the ones that if a blood clot were to form there and didn't get identified or treated, could break off, travel up to the lungs, and cause a serious blood clot.
Let me take 1 second and just remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One. My guest is Dr. Michael Jaff, and we're talking about deep vein thrombosis and some of the complications, one of the more notorious ones, pulmonary embolus. So if you've got questions or comments about what you're listening to today, let me give you a couple of phone numbers, but unfortunately I have to remind you that our email is not working today, so you can only give us phone calls during the time of the program. It's 550-8433 is our local number. 550-8433. The toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the usual reminder, if you're listening between 7 and 8 tonight, then you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. The live program is now, and that's when we'll be taking phone numbers. 550-8433. One of the things that caught me by surprise a little bit when I was looking at some of these statistics is that pulmonary embolus, a complication of deep vein thrombosis, is the leading cause of maternal death associated with childbirth in 2008. That shocked me.
It is a really sobering statistic. So if you think back in the early days of childbirth, as we were starting to learn about this as healthcare providers, the two major complications first were infection. That was a big problem. And then once that was taken over, it was anesthetic-related complications. Yeah. Well, we figured most of those things out, and except for very high-risk situations, those are usually not problems. But there's another risk factor that's common, pregnancy. Not only the actual pregnancy, but immediately following pregnancy, for the first few days after delivery, very high-risk situation for a percentage of women. And frankly, you can't think of a more catastrophic time to have this, a time when everybody's supposed to be happy and celebratory, and then you have this catastrophe occur.
Sure. Well, I guess the logical question that comes to my mind, and perhaps listeners, is what are the common underlying variables that may, in this group of people we've identified who might be at risk, and then there's going to be some specific individual, perhaps, risk we might get into later. But what's the common issues here between pregnancy and obesity and inactivity that comes to mind or that we know are factors?
Well, it's interesting. We know that there are three things that when they form together lead to the perfect storm. And this is a triad of risk that's been known back since the 1700s. So one is that the vein blood, again, in these thin-walled, non-muscular tubes, kind of sits still, doesn't propel up the leg like it's supposed to every time we take a step. And that situation, quite honestly, can be seen in anesthesia related to surgery. So you put somebody to sleep on a table and they have a four-hour operation, the vein blood in their legs isn't moving very well. So that's setup number one. Number two is damage to the inner lining of that vein. And we know that there's a thin layer of cells that line the inside of veins that protect the vein wall. And when those cells get scraped off or injured, It exposes a bunch of clotting factors that make the blood clot faster. Now, what could cause such an injury? Well, there are a couple obvious things you can think of. Breaking a bone. So, a skier who breaks a bone and has to get their leg set and put in a long bone cast, that damages the inner lining of the vein. Burns. Those kinds of things can be serious problems to the insides of vein walls and can lead to blood clots. Any kind of trauma. So that's number two in the triad. And the third one is a high propensity for clotting. And although most of us walk around thinking that we clot only when we're supposed to, it's a very delicate balance. You cut yourself shaving, you don't want to keep bleeding, right? You want to clot that cut. That's a good kind of clot. But you can develop clots in places that they're not supposed to be, like in veins, and that barometer of measurement is a very fine line that we're all walking. And if you think about it, there are a couple of very common things that lead to risk of clotting. One is pregnancy. Pregnant women make more clotting factors. Now, why would that be? Well, it's pretty obvious. When you have a baby, you don't want to keep bleeding. Mm-hmm. So once you mm-hmm. deliver the baby, you want those clotting factors to be there to stop any uterine bleeding. But sometimes that process gets a little too overboard. Another one is oral contraceptive use. Very commonly used, oftentimes very appropriate, but in fact it increases the risk of clotting, especially in young cigarette-smoking women. Mm-hmm. So you can see if you put those three together, slow or no movement of vein blood, damage to the inner lining of the veins, and a localized propensity for clotting, bam, you're hit with a setup.
Another risk that we've not identified, which has been in the news, I think, quite a bit, and people may have heard of, is long-distance airline flights.
Yeah.
And I guess the question comes in my mind, is the flight, the long time in the air, the major risk factor, or is it just is it just happened to be at the scene of an accident and someone who's already having predisposed problems? And how much is sitting in an airplane for a long time the big risk factor?
I actually think that it is the big risk factor.
Okay.
Now,
right.
A couple of things to clear up. They used to call it the economy class syndrome. In other words, if you got stuck in the back of the plane, you were more likely to get it. Turns out not to be the case.
Okay.
So if you're on a flight that's about 8 hours or longer, and for your listeners, that's probably not that uncommon. That's a risk factor. But, there's something about an airplane. First of all, most of us in flights that long tend to sleep in one position. When you're in bed at night, you're tossing and turning, moving around. But when you're in one of those chairs, no matter what row you're sitting in, you're sitting still. Number two, the air in an airplane is drier. It's dehumidified.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, you get a little dehydrated. When you have natural loss of your own body fluids through skin, through breathing, you get a little dehydrated. So that makes your blood a little sludgier. And then the last thing is the change in atmospheric pressure. We really think that also has an impact on this. So you knock all those three things together, and the risk, in fact, does go up. And there have been some good studies showing that about 8 hours is the cutoff time. You have to start thinking about that.
A couple of other risk factors that I have come across in reading about this is one is the ongoing treatment for cancer, which I was not aware of as a risk factor. And then one we should mention is sometimes we have deeper lines being placed that are necessary to supply antibiotics or medications. And that makes sense if you have a foreign body in a deep vein, that maybe that is a risk factor as well. Is that true? And then particularly, what's going on with cancer that may increase your risk?
So I'll take the easier one first. So if you have a foreign object, you're exactly right, inside a vein, that's going to rub the inner lining of those cells and expose them. So there's the perfect setup for that that sludge and the clot. And the one that you really think about are pacemaker leads. Defibrillator leads.
Huh.
All those sitting in main veins in the upper extremity are increases of risk for clotting.
Uh-huh.
Now let's talk a little bit about cancer. So it turns out that there are certain types of cancer that are pro-clotting. And those are mostly the kind that you call adenocarcinoma, as opposed to squamous cell carcinoma. So a couple of examples of adenocarcinoma are breast, lung, and colon, three very common cancers. They tend to secrete cells or factors that promote clotting. Now, if you want to make matters worse, it turns out that patients who are undergoing certain types of chemotherapy for their cancer also increase that risk above and beyond just having cancer. So in many situations, doctors will give medications ahead of time or while they're giving certain types of therapies to lower that risk. But you're right. So again, if we're looking at common things that occur commonly, age over 40, overweight status, cancer, surgery, pregnancy, birth control pills, I mean, we're not talking about rare things here.
We had a recent incident that I'm going to use some information that I recall from a newspaper account and not because I know anything specific about the particular patient. I won't mention the patient's name, and I'm not sharing any information that wasn't public knowledge. But a world-class skier develops a deep vein thrombosis. She's noted to be flying around a lot. She had a very low heart rate as a general factor, but excellent condition. And then during evaluation was found to have factor 5 Leiden deficiency. So you want to comment on some of those issues and how it might relate to what we're talking about?
Well, this whole subject of do we have something in our bloodstream that makes us more likely to clot has gained a lot of interest over the past decade. Frankly, when you and I were in school, we were talking about this beforehand, you know, we didn't know about too many of these factors. There were only a handful, and they were very, very rare. But when you found them, they certainly increased the risk of clotting. We've learned about a couple over the past 5 to 10 years that have incredibly common incidents. One is the one you're talking about, factor 5 Leiden. This is a genetic change in one of the amino acid groups on our cells. And if you have this abnormality passed on likely from someone in your family heritage, it increases your risk quite significantly. The second one that we've learned a lot about is something called prothrombin gene mutation. And the name tells you right off the bat, it's a switch in a gene, and that also increases risk. What's interesting is that these are really very common, very common. And in fact, it all depends on whether you have one of the genes of this mutation or two. If you have one, it means your risk is higher, and you probably shouldn't take oral contraceptives if you're a female. And if you know about this and you break a bone and need a cast on your leg, you probably ought to receive some sort of medication to lower your risk. But if you have both of these genes, if you got them from both sides of the family, then you're looking at a life-threatening risk of developing major blood clots, and you need to be treated pretty much for life with blood thinners to prevent your risk. So you're right, we're learning a lot about added underlying substances or genetic changes in our blood that increase our risk.
Mm-hmm. And you can be, just as a corollary of this, a world-class athlete in great condition, and that's not doesn't make you immune.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think most of your listeners know the story of David Bloom, who was the NBC television reporter several years ago, and this, again, is not private. This is public knowledge. His wife's a national spokesperson for prevention of DVT, and Mr. Bloom was apparently the rising star in NBC, was embedded in the U.S. military forces in Iraq early on in the early stages of the war, and he died in a tank. And the initial reports came out was that the tank came under fire, when in fact that wasn't the case. He died from a massive pulmonary embolus. Totally healthy guy, no medical history whatsoever. And in fact, post-mortem, when he was tested, he had factor 5 Leiden. So here was a healthy guy who was in 100-degree heat in a tank, dehydrated, staying in a small, confined place for a long time, and he had it and died.
We have a couple of callers, Dr. Jaff. I'm going to take one of those right now. Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, it's very interesting you should talk about the athletes, because we are very, very aware here in Anchorage of our star cross-country athlete who, you know, had the blood clot, and I hope you'll talk more about it. And that raises a second question. Should we, is there a simple test, and should we be tested for this factor before we get into trouble? Then the other is, but please talk more about some genetic conditions, or is there only one that might lead to this clotting later in life? And what about heart valve regurgitation, people who have that? Is there any indication that clotting is a problem? If so, what do we do?
Okay. Let me make sure I've got, you know, you asked the question about testing, and that's on the agenda. We got that. And you want to know about some heart problems that may lead. Your second point, again, I just for clarity for me, was...
Are there other genetic conditions that people have?
Okay.
That we should know about?
Besides blood-related or clotting mechanisms you're talking about?
That result in some clotting, yes.
Okie doke. We will see if we can get some answers for you. Dr. Jaff, you want to try that?
Well, I think that there are a number of other disorders that increase the propensity for clotting. They don't necessarily have to be genetic. For example, there are connective tissue diseases. There are cousins of lupus or even lupus itself that increase the risk for clotting. There are some very unusual disorders that present with blood clots themselves, but what we're talking about from a population standpoint are disorders that are relatively common. And it turns out that even if you were to screen the population identified at risk for blood clots for all of these kind of genetic determinants, you still would only find them in a minority of patients. So, first of all, the tests are not simple. They're relatively involved blood tests. I mean, they're simple for the patient to give blood, but to run them isn't simple. And they're extraordinarily expensive. And quite frankly, like I said, if you had one of the two markers for this clotting abnormality, let's say you had factor V Leiden and you just had one of the two sides, and you never had an event, well, we wouldn't tell you to do anything. We would tell you to, you know, stay healthy and do all the things you ought to do. Get your ideal body weight and stay physically active and see your doctor regularly. And so it probably wouldn't change your risk. Now, that's different if, let's say, someone in your family had a blood clot in an early age, and now you're looking to get pregnant. That's a different story. So, again, a lot of it's based on how we deal with genetics for all sorts of disorders. We do a screen of your genetic history and see if, in fact, you fall under the guidelines of someone who might be worthwhile to be tested and then give an appropriate preventive therapy to prevent the disaster from occurring.
How about Diane's question about aortic insufficiency, or let's even throw in atrial fibrillation, some of the heart abnormalities, some of which may be associated with age and disease of the heart. Does that significantly raise this risk?
So when we're talking about blood clots, again, I want to go back to your very insightful opening comment about the difference between arteries and veins. And I'm not really familiar with aortic insufficiency, a leaky heart valve, or even mitral regurgitation and a risk of blood clots in veins. However, I would say this. Congestive heart failure clearly increases the risk for blood clots in veins. Atrial fibrillation, a very common irregularity of the heart rhythm, increases the risk of blood clots forming in the heart and then breaking off and going somewhere else, most likely to the brain, causing a stroke. But again, I don't want to mix apples and oranges here. That would be an artery-to-artery blood clot. We're talking about vein-to-vein blood clots today.
Okay. All right, another caller. Paul, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You've talked quite a bit about the clotting mechanism and how that can increase the chances of these things happening. But how about on the other side? are there any improper clot dissolution problems that could lead to similar things? And I'll have to take my answer off the air.
All right, Paul, you know too much. that's a very, very good question. So now we got a clot. Sometimes maybe we got a clot that we can't get rid of because our mechanism doesn't work so well.
Yeah, no doubt about it. That's a very, very smart and insightful question. And it goes back to that kind of that barometer I was talking about that walks a very thin line. You can either have the line tipping a little to the left, which means you clot more easily, or it tips a little to the right, which means you don't dissolve a clot quite as readily. There are factors on both sides of that needle, and they both have to be completely in line to keep the needle pointing straight up. Once it tips one side or another, your risk goes up. So you're right. There are a whole bunch of what are called fibrinolytic or dysfibrinogenemic problems, and just by saying the word, my tongue gets tied. So it's a long answer. But you're right.
Right. So a couple of points here that are probably worth maybe expanding on is a lot of the of not just humans, all animals, all organisms have very evolved, very finely tuned, very nicely calibrated regulatory systems that work great most of the time. But sometimes evolution causes us to change very, very quickly from a very active person or type of animal to a more sedentary, now in the hospital getting all kinds of things put in our veins in a very short period of time, or something else happens genetically, and that raises the risk factors. It puts that needle on the other side, and that's kind of to put this into some maybe bigger perspective for our listeners.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to look at it. We sometimes put ourselves in situations where illness puts us in a situation where our body can't quite adapt and the corrective mechanism falls a little behind. And and so it's important that we keep tabs on all of this.
And I also want to flesh out a little bit more because it gets into this whole medical decision-making issue. And that's, let's say, for example, a physician wants to give a patient a birth control pill, and you've already mentioned that birth control pills are a risk factor. I'm not aware that there's any recommendation to screen individuals across the board for factor 5 Leiden deficiency or prothrombin gene mutation, although I think there is a recommendation to ask about a family history of blood clotting. So the question is, why not screen everyone who gets put on a birth control pill for these deficiencies?
What a fantastic question, one that I continue to ask anybody who I think is an expert who would be willing to give me an answer. And I must tell you, I get a whole gamut of answers here. But I think the short answer for your listeners is, if there's any family history of sudden death that's unexplainable, recurrent phlebitis, blood clots in veins, even just superficial veins, and you're considering either using an oral contraceptive or having a relative put on one, I see absolutely nothing wrong with getting checked. And the reason for that is that the risk of blood clots when you take someone with factor 5 Leiden or prothrombin gene mutation and give them a birth control pill is about 20-fold greater. So we're looking at a very serious risk. A very good colleague of mine at the Mayo Clinic, who does a lot of the same stuff I do, says that he is starting to recommend screening for people who are being considered for oral contraceptives. Now, I have to tell you, from a healthcare economic standpoint, I doubt that would pass muster.
Right.
Think about how many prescriptions for oral contraceptives are written every year in the United States. But it shows you how seriously we're taking a potentially very serious problem.
Yeah, and yeah, what you're saying is this is not cheap. I don't know what it costs to do these, but usually it's done in a battery where you do multiple things, some of which are not nearly as common. But another issue in this is just because you have factor 5 Leiden deficiency or thrombin gene mutation, I don't know the answer to this question. I think if you have both, like you said, you have a much higher risk. But what percentage of people who have those live their life without ever having a blood clot? I mean, you have to look at the other side of this issue as well. Do we know answers to questions like that?
No, and the reason we don't know is because we've known about these genetic abnormalities for about a decade only. Mm-hmm. So we don't have lifetime risk results. But I will tell you this. If you're heterozygote, which means you only got one of the two genes for these abnormalities, it's most likely that you're going to live your life without having a thrombotic event. And usually, something else is added to that. So, you know, a 12-hour plane flight where you slept the whole time, didn't drink a glass of water, didn't move your legs all the time. Or, you know, a person who has a long bone fracture is put in a cast and cast stays on for months. You know, those kinds of things that will tip somebody over. So I think you're right. I think, you know, we need to keep it in perspective of what's the long-term population-based risk.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Michael Jaff. He is the medical director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Vascular Center. We're talking about deep vein thromboses, why they occur, who's at risk. We're going to talk about symptoms and prevention shortly. If you've got questions or comments, why don't you give us a call? excuse me, in Anchorage. It's 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, our number is 1-888-353-5752. And for today only, our email is down, so you're going to have to use the phone, 550-8433. Let's talk about symptoms. I think we've spent a lot of time on the basic understanding, but how might a person suspect they may have this problem?
Well, I think the first and most important rule for your listeners is understand what your risk is. So do kind of a risk profile for yourself. And the reason I say that is half of all patients who have a potentially lethal blood clot in the vein in the leg don't have a symptom at all from it. And that's a really striking statistic. So, you know, when we teach our residents and fellows in the hospital when to do tests for deep vein thrombosis, we start off by saying, what do you think the chances are before you order a test that that patient's going to have a blood clot? If it's a 25-year-old person who's totally healthy and feels well, and they walk in and you just say, hey, by the way, you want to test for a blood clot in your leg, the pre-test probability, the chances that that person's going to have a blood clot is very, very low. But if you take a 25-year-old competitive skier who hurts the leg and then the leg gets massively swollen, well, the pre-test probability of that person is very, very high. So I think you want to start off with what you think your risks are. If you were going to look at symptoms, the two most common symptoms are swelling and or pain in a leg, not both legs, but a leg. And most of the time I tell people that the swelling tends to be from the groin down, if it's a very large blood clot going up the leg, or from the knee down, if it's kind of isolated to the knee or the calf. The swelling can involve the foot. Usually, if you elevate the leg, the swelling might get a little better, but does not get back to normal, which should be a telltale sign that if some of your listeners have leg swelling every day, and when they wake up in the morning, the swelling's virtually gone, well, that's unlikely to be a blood clot. But remember, physical exam alone is not good enough. You got to suspect it. And then as far as pain, this can be anything. Aching, tightness, sharp pain, burning pain, hot sensation. I've heard every type of description for this.
How about pulmonary embolus then? What is that exactly, and what are the symptoms that occur that give the hint that that's something that's happened?
So pulmonary embolus is the worst part of blood clots or deep vein thrombosis. This is when a blood clot in a vein in a leg breaks off and goes up to the lungs and blocks blood flow in the lungs. And so the symptoms that people will feel will be sudden onset of severe shortness of breath, cannot catch their breath, sometimes what we call pleurisy or pain in the chest wall when you take a deep breath. And then the other ones that I really want people to think about are syncope, passing out. That can be one of the most important first manifestations of a blood clot. And also coughing, specifically coughing up any bright red blood. That would be a sign of something potentially very dangerous like a blood clot. So those would be the main symptoms of a pulmonary embolus.
We have another caller. I wanted to take Marcia. Marcia, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a couple of questions primarily related to... I'm sorry, I thought I had my phone off or my radio off. Related to the length of time after, let's say, a hospitalization or a situation where you've been immobilized for whatever reason for a period of time or had a PICC line, that you're more susceptible to clots.
Yeah, how does the risk change over time after you remove some of those risks, primarily being in the hospital?
Immobilized because you have to have your legs up or had a PICC line and had that removed. What's the length of time afterwards?
So a couple of quick answers. If it's purely just because you've been immobilized, let's say you got a bad flu and you had to get admitted because you're dehydrated, really, we believe that as soon as you're up and back at them, back to your full strength, physically active, walking, doing the things you need to do, like to routinely do, your risk is pretty much back to baseline. From a PICC line standpoint, when the catheter is out, PICC line stands for peripherally inserted central catheter, When that's taken out of a vein, give it about 24 hours, that risk is pretty much gone. The one that you got to really remember about are those patients who undergo total joint replacement, hip or knee replacement. It's believed that their risk extends about 3 weeks after the operation's done. So you can imagine now with people getting discharged from the hospital after 3 or 4 days, those people are still at significant risk of developing phlebitis and deep vein blood clots up to 3 weeks after their operation's been done.
Thank you. Good information.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Marcia. And that raises another question in my mind. There are clearly more knee and hip replacements being done in the last 10 to 15 years than there has been. Do we have evidence that that is a significant complication of these procedures? And if so, what are we doing about it?
There is irrefutable evidence that if you undergo a hip or a knee replacement, your risk of developing a blood clot in a vein, if you do nothing to lower that risk, is upwards of 40 to 70% higher. And in fact, some studies have shown very nicely that there's a 1 to 4% fatal pulmonary embolism rate. That means 1 to 4% of people who undergo an elective hip or knee replacement could die from a pulmonary embolus as a result of that surgery. So it is a major, major risk factor. And there is a lot being done. In fact, there are national published guidelines that tell physicians exactly what should be done for patients who undergo hip or knee replacement to lower that risk to a more acceptable level.
And the other question that popped in my mind was dehydration. It seems to make some sense that dehydration may be a risk. Is that, in fact, the case?
I think we believe it's the case if it's dehydration associated with a medical illness. So if somebody runs a marathon and gets dehydrated, you know, it's unlikely, unless they had some other factor going on, that they would suffer a major deep vein thrombosis. But if somebody gets dehydration from, let's say, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, or they get dehydrated from pneumonia because they're not eating and they're at bed rest, you see, I'm putting, again, that profile of risk together. Right. Dehydration is certainly one that could lead to sludging of blood and ultimately increase in blood clots.
Nope. Got another caller. I'm going to go ahead and take that as well. Nan, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm calling. We have a family member who's homozygous for factor V Leiden. He is on Coumadin. And our concern is always when he has any kind of a hospitalization, kind of the reverse, that when they take him off the Coumadin and reverse the effect that we worry during hospitalization that he's really at increased risk for DVT or some kind of embolism. And we're wondering what is the best or the current practice of treatment for an individual like that when they're hospitalized?
Great question.
Phenomenal question. It's like you planted that question for your audience here. So this raises the concept where someone who's homozygote for factor V Leiden, as I mentioned, has a prohibitively high risk of blood clots. So the fact that your family member's on Coumadin, a blood thinner, is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. If they need to come in the hospital to get an operation, let's say, or they get sick and they have to be hospitalized and they can't take Coumadin for some other reason, there are plenty of other non-orally based blood thinners that are given. And what we do if someone needs an operation, an invasive procedure or something, is we'll bring them in the hospital, let them stop their Coumadin, give them this other type of blood thinning medication to keep their risk as low as it can be. Then they have their procedure, and then as soon as it's safe after the procedure, we get them up and out of bed, we get them back on their blood thinners. We don't let a lot of time lag. It's oftentimes a very tightrope between making sure they don't clot and making sure they don't bleed. So you really need a good team of physicians together who are working closely to get your best outcome. But this is a very common problem that we deal with literally on a daily basis.
So generally speaking, if he would be able to be up and around, would that kind of be the marker? Sometimes he's in Fairbanks, and sometimes I think it's people don't have a good enough knowledge base, and we kind of feel like the doctors aren't really 100% sure when they should start the blood thinners again.
Well, again, it's hard for me to give advice to a specific patient, particularly as far away as I am, but I would tell you that in general, in someone who's homozygote for factor V Leiden, if they can't take their Coumadin, we give them something else. It's not okay. just getting them out of bed quickly that's good enough protection.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. All right, so now we're back. We hopefully are having some understanding of the risk factors and how this problem's developed and some of the symptoms. What do you do as a physician to diagnose this?
Well, the good news is we have ways of diagnosing this that are not scary. They're not invasive. They're not painful. They're not risky to the patient. And the most common one to diagnose a deep vein thrombosis is an ultrasound test. And this uses Doppler sound waves, kind of like the Doppler that's used in the weather forecast, where we actually can look at the vein blood and determine if there's any blood clotting going on. A very effective test if done by a good technologist, read by a physician skilled in interpreting this, and using the appropriate modern technology, all of which I'm sure is there. So that's the first and most important test. Now, the other good thing is that there's a blood test, believe it or not, that can help you predict if someone's having an active blood clot or not. And that blood clot is called a D-dimer test. That's a readily available blood test that, if positive, tells you that the patient's likely forming clots. Now, there are other reasons that people have a positive D-dimer test. So what we tell everybody is this test is really only helpful if it's negative. So if someone comes in with leg pain and you draw a D-dimer test and the D-dimer is completely normal, the chances of that person having a blood clot in a leg that's going to go to their lungs and kill them is almost zero. It's a great test. But if it's abnormal, it doesn't mean they have a blood clot. So, you know, you need to use the test wisely. But those are the two most common tests that are used now to diagnose deep vein thrombosis.
I suspect the old venograms that I was familiar with are not as commonly used and are certainly not as pleasant.
You're absolutely right. So venograms were the tests done back in the days when you and I were learning this stuff where a needle's placed in a vein on the top of the foot. So right away your audience is cringing, as am I. And then you'd inject this iodine-based dye into that vein, wrap tourniquets around the legs, and force that dye into the deep veins, and then take x-ray pictures as it goes up the leg. And oftentimes patients were placed on special types of tables that tilted them on their head so that the vein blood would drain up towards the heart. And aside from it being unpleasant and fairly time-consuming, 1-2% of people who get a venogram actually got a blood clot as a result of it. The dye itself irritated the inner lining of the vein. So the only time we do venograms anymore is if we're going to try and dissolve the blood clot, not to make a diagnosis.
Okay. How about treatment? What do we need to think of when we start thinking about treatment? What are the goals and what do we have to achieve those goals?
So the number one goal for treatment is preventing the clot from growing, breaking off, and going to the lungs. That in and of itself is the most important first step, and that's why early diagnosis and early therapy is critical. And so what we do is we start a blood thinner that will thin the blood almost immediately. So the problem is the only blood thinners we have that will do that are blood thinners that can't be taken by mouth. They're either given by shots, like an insulin type of shot, or they're given through an IV, most of the time now done through subcutaneous or insulin type shots. And there are lots of those that are available, and they work very well. Depending on which one you use, they can thin the blood between 4 to 6 to 8 hours after the first dose is given. So it works very nicely. And in certain people, it's actually allowed us to treat their blood clot without ever having to come into the hospital, which is a very nice thing. Patients rightfully don't love being in hospitals, and it's nice to be able to do this at home. So that's goal number one, preventing the blood clot breaking off and going to the lungs. Now, the second goal, which I think everybody would want, would be to get rid of the blood clot. And frankly, if you use blood thinners, as I just mentioned, as your only line of therapy, only about 20% of people will completely dissolve the blood clot and make the vein back to normal. Only about 20%. The rest of us will be left with either a scarred vein or a damaged vein valve or a completely blocked vein. So in those situations, we like to think about dissolving the blood clot to get rid of it. And we can't use blood thinners because blood thinners don't work. We have to use clot dissolvers, or what many of your audience knows are clot busters. And the problem with those is that they can't be given by mouth, they can't be given by an IV or even a subcutaneous insulin-like injection. They have to be given directly into the clot. So this is an invasive procedure. And in fact, the risk of bleeding with these procedures goes up. So there's actually a National Institutes of Health-sponsored trial that's probably going to start either the end of this year or early 2009. That's finally going to give us the answer to the question we've all been waiting for, which is, if you dissolve a blood clot in a vein in a leg, does the patient feel better and live longer in the long term with a healthier vein and a healthier leg than if you just treat them with a blood thinner? We still don't know that answer. So hopefully we'll get that answer through this trial.
So one of the things I've talked about often on this program is thinking about safety, or is the treatment safe and effective? And what you're saying, what we don't know right now about breaking down these clots is, are they safe and are they effective? Effective in the sense, are you better off than without them? And
that's
it
right.
Takes a controlled study to answer that question.
Absolutely true. So, you know, in young people who have very low bleeding risk and have a really swollen leg from a big blood clot, we most often will try dissolving that blood clot first. But in someone who's older, who has other risk factors, you know, cancer of the intestines, recent head trauma, inflammatory bowel disease, other bleeding risks, peptic ulcer disease, we probably wouldn't want to use a blood clot dissolver, because then you're adding risk to an already difficult situation.
Okay. We have another caller. George, you're on line one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is the effect or the impact of diabetes and diet on this subject area. Is there a way to eat, or is there any preventive type things that people can do to reduce some of the issues that come up once you have the problem?
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, George. What I'm hearing George ask is two questions. One is, does diabetes have an impact? And then two, we're getting more into maybe prevention. Is there some dietary maneuver that may increase the risk or help prevent the risk?
I'm not familiar with a link directly between diabetes and vein blood clots. This is one of the few vascular disorders that I can say that about. However, there absolutely is an association between diet and deep vein blood clots, and I think you already all know the answer. If you're eating the wrong things and you're above your ideal body weight, you automatically get one risk factor for blood clots on the bad side of the scorecard. So you want to eat healthy so that you maintain a thin, normal, ideal body weight, and then you lower your risk. Now, watching your saturated fat specifically, eating less salt-containing food specifically, we don't really know whether those have an impact on the formation of blood clots, but the bottom line is you got to stay at your ideal body weight to avoid that one risk factor for blood clots.
Other than that, there are no dietary manipulations that directly, other than caloric over calorie intake, that directly may worsen your risk or improve your risk.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm not familiar with any other dietary links.
Okey-doke. We have another caller, and I'm going to take her question in just a minute, but I want to make a comment. We've been using the term blood thinner, and I want to make sure people understand that, what is that called, a colloquialism? Thinning is not, we're not making your blood really thinner. What we're meant when we say that, we're meaning that we make it less likely to clot. Is that fair to say?
100% correct.
Okey-doke. Diane is on line one. Diane, what can we do for you?
Yes, if a patient has factor V Leiden, a single gene, and possibly has PACs, a few SVTs, and maybe atrial fib, what is the risk factor for developing blood clots, and what would the treatment be?
Okay, and let's define those abbreviations while we're at it, okay?
So you're asking if someone's got one of the two genetic links for factor V Leiden, they've never had a deep vein blood clot, and yet they have premature atrial contractions. Those are like skipped heartbeats.
Right.
You said supraventricular tachycardia, SVT.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a rapid heartbeat or atrial fibrillation, that irregular heartbeat that we mentioned before. What's the risk there for formation of deep vein blood clots? Is that right?
And what would the treatment be?
Okay. So one of the physical findings of a blood clot to the lungs is in fact atrial fibrillation. So someone who's always had a normal rhythm suddenly presents with atrial fibrillation. One of the things you got to think about in your risk of why that happened, one of the things on the list is a pulmonary embolus.
Is
a pulmonary embolus, the blood clots to the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
But just having, let's say they're unrelated. Let's say you have this factor V Leiden that was found for whatever reason, and you have atrial fibrillation. What's the associated link? And in fact, it's not clear that there is an associated link. One of the things that's been interestingly studied lately is, does factor V Leiden increase the risk of artery blood clots? Some investigators think it does. Most think it does not. The data is very thin on that, so we're waiting to see some more data come out on that. But the bottom line is that, as I mentioned earlier, we wouldn't necessarily check somebody for factor V Leiden if they had PACs, SVT, or atrial fibrillation.
But say a patient did have factor V Leiden, single gene, and discovered that person was having PACs and SVTs, is it necessary to prescribe Coumadin or a blood thinner, or can that patient live without going on Coumadin with little risk?
Again, not being able to give single advice this far away, I would tell you this. Most people believe that atrial fibrillation needs to be treated with Coumadin, not to prevent blood clots in veins in the legs, but to prevent a blood clot in the heart that would then break off and go to the brain, causing a stroke.
Exactly.
So that would be important, but that's unrelated to the factor V Leiden. That's just having atrial fibrillation.
Right. But if someone did have factor V Leiden and had PACs, let's say, and SVTs, is there a greater risk for a blood clot?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And how effective is Coumadin? Say somebody had a pacemaker and was on Coumadin. How effective is Coumadin to prevent a blood clot in that patient? Say that patient has factor V Leiden.
So someone's got a pacemaker a slow heart rate, for example?
Yes, a relative
of
mine does, yes.
Pacemaker and they have factor V Leiden?
Yes.
How effective is Coumadin? So again, I wouldn't necessarily use Coumadin in someone who has a pacemaker placed for a slow heart rhythm. If they had a pacemaker placed for atrial fibrillation and a slow heart rhythm, Coumadin's very effective in that situation of lowering risk of stroke, even if they have factor V Leiden.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk some more about prevention now. What can we do? In particular, we want to address these long flights out of Alaska to Hawaii most of the time. No, I'm just kidding. Sometimes we go to Minnesota, but not very often. What are your suggestions, Doctor?
So for long plane flights, if someone's never had a blood clot before and they don't have a known abnormality, they don't have an adenocarcinoma, for example, they don't have inflammatory bowel disease, then there are a couple of basic things that I always recommend. One is drink lots of water on the airplane. Remember I mentioned that the air is dehumidified, so you get a little dehydrated. Now notice I didn't say drink lots. I said drink lots of water, because sometimes people think I mean drink lots of alcohol. And in fact, alcohol dehydrates you as well. So we would say to avoid much alcohol, drink lots of water. Number two, there are some simple exercises you can do in your seat in the plane that will significantly lower your risk. And those would be raising and lowering your toes, squeezing and releasing your calves, do circles at your ankles with your feet, and if the airplane folks will ever let you, get up and walk the aisles. That's getting harder to let them to get you to do as flying has become more challenging. But those are the kind of things. If you have a tendency to get leg swelling when you're on an airplane for a long flight, I would suggest that you speak to your doctor about getting the appropriate sized and styled compression stockings to wear before you get on the plane until after you get off the plane to control that swelling and lower your risk of developing significant swelling and blood clots.
We've got about 3 minutes and maybe a little longer than we need to get off the air, but I want to give you a chance here to say what's important or things that we have not addressed that you think need to be said about deep vein thrombosis.
Well, I guess the one thing we haven't talked about is since I started off the hour by saying that pulmonary embolus is the likely the number one cause of death in hospitalized patients. How do we prevent that risk? How do you, as someone who goes into a hospital, know that you're doing everything you can? And in fact, if you have several risk factors, if you're over the age of 40, if you're over the ideal body weight, if you have cancer, if you're having surgery, if you're on a birth control pill, you need to do something to lower your risk. Now, that something might be wearing special type of graduated compression stockings on your leg during your hospital stay. It may be actually wearing a device on your leg or foot that rhythmically pumps and releases to accelerate that vein blood moving out of your legs. And it may mean that you need to get a shot of a blood thinner once a day to lower your risk. Those are the kind of things that there are very well-published guidelines for physicians and healthcare providers to follow. So, you know, you certainly want to be your best advocate. I'm sure you tell your listeners that. I say this to my patients all the time. No one knows more about what you're worried about than you. So if you're concerned going into a hospital that you want to know your risk of blood clots is lower, ask your doctor what needs to be done to lower my risk.
And I think we should say, I had noticed before and then after we had scheduled this program, there's certainly a bigger effort being made at the local hospitals here to draw attention to the risk so that everyone's kind of thinking about this. And you tell me that the same thing's going on back at Massachusetts General Hospital.
No doubt about it. I mean, we all recognize now that this is a major health hazard. We have not, as a group, done a good job of lowering people's risk across the board. Some hospitals use alerts when doctors write orders on the computer. We've got signs all over the hospital. The residents and house staff are all being trained, but this is a big deal. We need to pay attention to this.
All right. Well, I want to let everybody know you've taken time from a vacation back out on Cape Cod and to do this. So that's beyond the call of duty, and we really appreciate it. I hope you have a remaining wonderful evening, and thanks again very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All righty. Our thanks again, especially to Dr. Michael Jaff of the Massachusetts General Hospital for joining us today. Next week, we're going to be back, and we're going to be talking about basic research. I think it might be useful to understand how just simple basic research on things like frogs can help us understand medical disorders as complex as Williams syndrome and cataracts. So we'll be talking to Jocelyn Krebs, a biologist at the University of Alaska Anchorage, who's doing some research in this very area. So tune into your health and learn more Monday, August 18th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.